Coming up, as ISIS ramps up recruiting efforts in the West, Tim Lawton looks at new initiatives by U.S. Muslim groups trying to prevent violent Islamist extremism from taking hold here. Also, David Taraschuk on Southern Baptists in Louisiana who needed a church building and trucked one in from Nova Scotia 2,000 miles away. Plus, belief and practice, young Jews serving the homeless.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, President Obama was in Myanmar for the East Asia Summit, a meeting of regional leaders. It was his second visit in 2 years to the country, which emerged from military rule 4 years ago. Obama pressed lawmakers in the largely Buddhist country to speed up reforms, such as protecting the rights of the Rohingya Muslim minority. Many Rohingya are considered stateless, and the UN has called them one of the most persecuted minorities in the world. Here in the U.S., an emotional welcome home for two Americans who had been jailed in North Korea, Kenneth Bay and Matthew Todd Miller. They were released after a top U.S. intelligence official visited North Korea, although it's unclear what exactly led to their freedom. Bay is a devout Christian who was arrested in 2012 and sentenced to 15 years of hard labor for allegedly plotting against the North Korean government. He is now recovering from ailments he suffered in prison. Dr. Craig Spencer returned home this week from a New York City hospital after testing free of the Ebola virus. He'd been diagnosed with the virus 3 weeks ago after treating Ebola patients in Guinea. Vice President Joe Biden praised faith groups for their efforts to fight the disease in West Africa. He said their ability to understand cultural differences makes them effective. In Liberia, the state of emergency was lifted due to the declining rate of infections, though the country remains on alert amid reports of new outbreaks in rural areas. A human rights group said this week that U.S.-led airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Syria have killed more than 860 people, including 50 civilians. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said women and children were among the civilian deaths. Meanwhile, the U.S. continued its assault on ISIS around the Syrian border town of Kobani. In recent weeks, Kurdish fighters from Iraq have arrived to help defend the strategic town. ISIS and other extremist groups have been waging an active campaign, especially on social media, to recruit Muslims in other parts of the world to join them. Studies show that only a tiny percentage of American Muslims are committing terrorist acts or leaving to fight with ISIS. Still, in the face of the challenge, more and more U.S. Muslim groups are launching new initiatives to prevent violent extremism from taking hold in their communities. And, as Kim Lawton reports, some of the efforts have been controversial.
In Washington, D.C., Imam Zia Makhdoum and his wife Fatima Popel are participating in an annual interfaith unity walk.
You're probably going to need another box for this.
They've brought along members of Makespace, the group they founded in 2012 for young Muslims. It's been a full day of learning about other religious traditions and doing a service project, making meals for the homeless. The couple says activities like this build a positive self-identity among young American Muslims, and they believe that will help prevent the youth from becoming susceptible to extremist ideas.
We want to feel as though we are part of the society. You can be a Muslim and an American at the same time.
You can't just say I'm an American and then not give back to your country. So this is an opportunity to bridge gaps and to create dialogue and positive dialogue.
As ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups ramp up their recruiting efforts in the West, many Islamic organizations in the U.S. are launching new initiatives aimed at preventing radicalization. They say while the number of American Muslims seeking to commit acts of terror is small, the issue must be addressed.
Our biggest problem as Muslims and what we're facing right now is extremism. We need to nip it in the bud, and that is creating these healthy communities, and not just here in America, but all around the world, so that Muslims can talk about these issues in an open environment and really take back our faith.
But it's been a controversial prospect. Some Muslims fear new projects to combat extremism will imply that the problem is bigger than it really is. And other Muslim voices are pushing for even more internal critique.
The pathway to get there does involve airing dirty laundry, does involve open public acknowledgement that we have core interpretations, not the scripture, but interpretations of the scripture that need to be modernized and are used by radicals.
Earlier this year, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, released its Safe Spaces Initiative, which the group describes as a toolkit to help mosques and local community centers combat violent extremism. MPAC national policy analyst Hoda El-Shastawi says they recommend a multi-step process, which starts with holistic projects to help prevent extremism from ever taking hold.
Usually what we found in a majority of these cases is that troubled individuals really have underlying issues, whether it's mental health issues, family issues at home, that these issues are not being dealt with. So our prevention programs are creating these safe spaces so that people can talk about issues and grievances that they have and work through them in a healthy way.
Imam Makhdoom says his Make Space group tries to provide a constructive platform for discussion of grievances about things like perceived discrimination and racial profiling or disagreements with U.S. foreign policy.
And so we seek God's guidance and we seek his mercy and we seek his assistance in all our affairs.
He believes religious education is another key element for preventing radicalization.
The more they understand Islam and the teaching of Islam, the less likely they are to fall for that kind of thing. And research has shown that.
The Quran really is a book about choices, right?
Makhdoom and a growing number of American Muslim leaders are taking their message online to try and reach young people through social media, the very place ideological extremists often wield the most influence.
It's important for the sane voices, the moderate voices, the true authentic voices of Islam to take the battle to them.
If an individual appears to be moving toward radicalization, MPAC urges community and religious leaders to surround that person in a proactive intervention. And after that, if the person seems to be moving toward violence, MPAC advises he or she should be ejected from the community with the knowledge of law enforcement. Across the country, Muslim groups have been trying to build good relationships with law enforcement to facilitate this. But El-Shastawi says there have been several points of tension.
You can talk about FBI tactics with informants. You can talk about the use of surveillance, widespread surveillance. There are real issues that we need to deal with as American Muslims and as we build those relationships with law enforcement.
In Phoenix, Arizona, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery has been meeting with members of the local Muslim community in an effort he hopes can be a model for other cities. He says trust needs to go both ways.
It can be challenging at times because of the continuing need to maintain that open dialogue and communication. It's too easy for people to fall back on stereotypes, whether out of ignorance or an outright effort to discriminate. So it's that constant communication that's required.
Even if someone is identified as a radical, Montgomery says often there's only so much law enforcement can do. That puts much of the responsibility back on the Muslim community.
We don't have a future crime squad, and we don't have thought police, but rather to bring those individuals to the attention of local community leaders who can help clarify what is and is not acceptable in authentic Islamic teaching.
One of the Muslim leaders Montgomery meets with regularly is Dr. Zudi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Allahu Akbar.
He says he's pleased more Muslim groups are trying to combat any extremism before it turns to violence. But he believes many of the new initiatives don't go deep enough in addressing ideology, what he calls the battle for the soul of Islam.
We love our faith, but we want to have a debate about what entails the identification and the laws and the rules of that faith. We need to have a vibrant criticism, critique of our ideologies so that we can grow.
Jasser has generated strong controversy within the Muslim community. He's highly critical of political Islam and urges what he calls the separation of mosque and state. He says sermons in too many U.S. mosques are focused on grievances.
Unfortunately, you know, there's just so much demonization of America that it becomes fodder for those kids that go off and become radicals to then feel they're justified in their acts of terror.
Jasser founded the Muslim Liberty Project to promote American values among young Muslim leaders. Courtney Lonergan and Seema Kassab lead the Muslim Liberty Project at Arizona State University. Lonergan is a convert to Islam who says she's been shocked by the level of anger she's heard inside some parts of the U.S. Muslim community.
I work with so many young people, it's easy just to take the blame somebody else and take the victim mindset. Oh, poor me, this is what happened. And there's not a lot that's happening in the community to empower young people.
The issue is that most Muslims aren't like that, but we have to go out there and show people that. We have to show the world that Muslims themselves.
If you instill in our youth and in our Muslim communities a love and passion for America, for liberty, for a nation state based in freedom, that all people are equal, they would never be radicalized.
Hoda El-Shastawi says it's important to tackle the problem of extremism without condemning all of Islam or fomenting anti-Muslim bigotry. She says American Muslims won't allow their faith to be defined by ISIS.
They are destruction. They have nothing to do with building of life, whereas Islam is about enjoining what is good. It's about life. It's about preserving human rights, dignity, justice. And so what we've seen is that Muslims now are taking back that narrative.
She says grassroots, community-wide efforts are the only way that can happen. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Next week, we'll have a special report on some of the people who were attracted to ISIS. Thousands of Jewish leaders gathered this week in Washington, D.C. for the Jewish Federation's General Assembly. They discussed a broad range of issues facing the global Jewish community, such as rising anti-Semitism. Among the speakers were Supreme Court Justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, who are both Jewish. Breyer said he's guided by the Torah's emphasis on justice, in Hebrew, tzedek.
And there is a message, and the message has something to do with tzedek, and it has something to do with tzedakah, and it has something to do with social justice, and the law should work out so that there is not too much injustice in the way in which it does work out. Now, those are things I think. Those are things Elena thinks. Those are things we all think.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, has been conducting an internet campaign of transparency about its history. A recent subject is the marital status of the church's founder and prophet, Joseph Smith, long admired by Mormons as an exemplary man. Now, the church acknowledges that Smith had up to 40 wives, some already married, and one just 14 years old. Should public schools be closed for the Muslim holy day of Eid al-Adha? In Montgomery County, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., Muslims have insisted that they should have the same rights on their holidays that Christians and Jews have on theirs. But the County Board of Education says there aren't enough Muslim students to justify a day off for everyone. So school officials are taking all the religious names of the holidays off their calendar while keeping only the existing days off. In rural Nova Scotia, a dwindling Anglican congregation had to sell its 200-year-old building. In deep south Louisiana, a Southern Baptist congregation needed a new sanctuary. So, as David Taraschuk reports, the Baptists bought the Anglicans' building, which was taken apart and trucked 2,000 miles to Cajun country, where the Baptists are putting it back together, piece by numbered piece.
In Abita Springs, Louisiana, the wooden framework of a 40-foot tower goes up as this Deep South community throws itself into a major building effort. These Southern Baptists are raising a new church through their own labors under the guidance of a professional timber specialist.
You have the congregation pitching in and becoming part of the construction team. It's an honor to be working with somebody who cares about what they're going to be getting.
The church that's taking shape here in Abita Springs may be new to the people who are going to be worshiping in it, but in fact it's very old. In fact, its story begins a good many years ago, and more remarkably perhaps, very far away from here. Off to the distant north on the Atlantic coast of Canada lies the largely rural province of Nova Scotia, and it's scattered with churches, often historic and classic in style. But at All Saints, a 200-year-old Anglican church in Granville Center, the congregation became so small in recent years that the parish could no longer maintain its building.
This is a part of rural Nova Scotia, and our issues around depopulation mean that we end up having buildings for which we have no future use.
As Nova Scotia churches have been decommissioned, they've sometimes become private homes. But the people of All Saints wanted their building to remain a sanctuary, even though it had to be sold.
The primary concern was that it continued to be a church for others. And having been here for as long as it has been, better that than simply being torn down and destroyed.
We pray, Lord, that you would be in everything that we touch.
And so the Louisianans entered the picture. Pastor Gerald Keene of Abita Springs wanted a real church to house his congregation. At the time, they had only makeshift worship arrangements, holding services in a child care facility. At first, Pastor Keene, with a historic structure in mind, searched for his ideal building just in the American South.
I began looking in the Delta, Mississippi Delta, along East Texas for old churches. After looking for maybe 7 or 8 months, a year, I saw something online in Nova Scotia, a nice church. And so I flew up there, liked what I saw, and I walked through a 9-foot door, and I said, wow, this is really nice. You know, this is the real thing. So I fell in love with it immediately. I told them I wanted it, we'll buy it, let's do it.
A mammoth task then followed. The church was taken apart. In itself, no easy matter because of the solid way it was originally built. Well-seasoned, old-growth spruce timbers and yellow birch braces, fashioned entirely in keeping with the area's rugged farm buildings.
One of the things about this building that's sort of interesting to me is it's built in the style of the barns by craftsmen who knew what they were doing. The whole building is very sturdily built.
Parishioners at All Saints, like Alan Slowenwhite, were proud of their church's historic past and were also now hopeful for its future.
What strikes me about it is the artsy-crafty that went into that building. They didn't have a chainsaw, the power tools that we have today, and you think that that building had been here, you know, all those years, since 1814. I'm in agreement with what's taking place. It's going somewhere else, and it's going to be put to good use.
The church's ancient timbers and its Georgian-style windows were loaded onto an 18-wheel tractor trailer, and they were trucked the entire 2,000 miles to southern Louisiana.
To me, getting it here was not even a question. I knew we could get materials here. It didn't seem like a big feat to me as a Christian. I know the Lord will give us whatever we ask for.
Then came the reassembling of all the timbers, each fitted again into its previously matching piece. It involved some struggle.
A lot of wiggling of heavy wood and a lot of maneuvering and tapping in dowels. Just imagine a big puzzle.
The team was helped, to some degree at least, by the original Nova Scotian builder's own coding that employed Roman numerals to identify each joint.
The Roman numeral, their numbering system, is all on the outside of the frame. So we labeled it with our own labeling system.
I'm double-checking that as we put it back together with their system.
Is it matching up?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, that's how I know that things are right for where they go.
While the church may be replicated physically in its new location, its style of worship will likely be greatly changed. The somber tone, often said to typify Canadian Anglicans, will be giving way to Southern Baptist enthusiasm.
I'm sure they love the Lord just like we do. Cultures are different. The sermons will be a little different. We do preach the gospel pretty strong. We have a wonderful pianist who jazzes up our hymnal. Everybody in our congregation sings. They sing loud. That's a rule. It's probably the only rule we have is sing loud. And we shake the place when we sing. You know, it's not somber.
The Southerners were effecting another change, too, in a curious coincidence of history. During the 18th century, Nova Scotia was home to the French-speaking Acadians. But the British authorities expelled them as threats to colonial rule, a story immortalized in Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's epic poem Evangeline. Later, many Acadians eventually ended up settling in Louisiana and were given the abbreviated label of Cajuns.
I was able to trace back all of my heritage except for my dad's father's side back to Nova Scotia.
Amy Keene is the pastor's wife and comes from a family well-rooted in Acadian Cajun traditions.
I grew up with my great-grandparents, and they spoke French. They did not speak English, and we would have a lot of that culture that's lost.
There's a kind of irony in that Amy's ancestors back in Nova Scotia, as Catholics and suspected rebels, would have been looked down on by the English-speaking Anglicans whose church is now hers and her family's.
They were maybe not really welcome everywhere that they tried to settle, you know, for different reasons.
And they may not have been welcome in that church.
No, probably not.
But whatever big changes may be taking place, continuity and harmony are also on the minds of those involved. Timber expert Dan Reagan's wife, Kimberly, co-owner of their restoration company, has worked to ensure the church's historic links remain unbroken.
I spoke with the congregation just before coming down here. They sent their warmest greetings, and there's hope of continuing dialogue between the two congregations.
And I just want to say to the folks in, where is it, Louisiana?
In Louisiana, yeah.
Well, to you folks in Louisiana that are going to put the church back up and make use of it, I just want to say congratulations, and I'm really happy that it's found a new and wonderful home. And I hope that you'll protect it from the termites, that's all.
Well, I heard that they were praying for us now as we're erecting this building, and I hope they feel like this is still their home. They can come camp out with us anytime they want to. They can use our building anytime they want to. It's a church. It's the Lord's. It's really not ours.
It's hoped that the church might be ready for use by Christmas time, when these revered old rafters will be ringing again to some very different rhythms from before. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Tereshchuk in southern Louisiana.
Finally, as the weather grows colder and the holidays approach, we have a belief and practice segment about young people of faith seeking to help those without shelter. We visited with the young adults of Six and I Synagogue in Washington, D.C., who served breakfast to the homeless in partnership with the interfaith group So Others Might Eat. Rabbi Scott Perlow was our guide.
I think for the generation of Jews that we work with here, the young professionals, social justice is their faith. In Judaism, we have this idea that obligation comes before analysis, and there's lots of stuff that you do just because you have to do it, and then you sort of figure out the why of it. We have, I think at the last count, something about 6,800 homeless people in the district, not to mention a huge problem with youth homelessness here. We don't have nearly enough beds for teens and youth who are homeless on the street. We work downtown. This is our spiritual community. You know, in some level, it would just be pretty egregious of us not to get involved. Basically, Torah, which is our word both for our holiest book and the assembled vast collection of all of Jewish wisdom, Torah is human dignity. And if it's not human dignity, it's not Torah. Being able to feed those who haven't been fed, to clothe the naked, and to house the homeless, I think is probably the spiritual apex of what the Torah is trying to teach. Everybody here is gifted with a soul that was fashioned in God's image, which is to say of divine eternal worth, of a worth that can't ever be taken away, which is the reason that if someone needs help from me, I really have to give it, because they are worth, in God's eyes, just the same as I am.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, performances from the Interfaith Unity Walk in Washington, D.C.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.